I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Second Movement, Christmas Rose, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With Martin Rose and Megazone. p.m. Earth Eastern Standard Time, Tuesday, December 22nd, 2404. Utena Tenjo had never traveled in outer space before. She had left the world of her birth, it was true, but that had been more of a translation than a journey. And since arriving on Earth, she hadn't left it, even if her passport did claim she was a citizen of the Republic of Zeta Cygni. That claim, as it happened, even had the advantage of being technically true, and the document genuine. But nevertheless, she had never been there. Thus, as she sat in the co-pilot's seat of the private starship Dagger Disc, New Avalon, SAE-6650, she had never before seen anything like what she was seeing now. Outside the windows was a swirling, sullen maelstrom of scarlet and black, dull red light permeating a formless black infinity. It was awesome and beautiful, but also a bit frightening and depressing. The cockpit door sighed open behind her, and Utena turned her head to see Kate's brother Corwin entering. He smiled at her, then quickly looked away, busying himself with some readouts that didn't need to be checked on the astrogation panel. With a private grin, Utena turned back to contemplating the weirdness outside. She supposed it was a bit cruel to be entertained by the boy's discomfiture, but she couldn't help it. There was something sweet about his awkwardness, and she got the impression he was as baffled by his own reaction as she was amused. Corwin duffed around with the astrocomputer for several more minutes before finally deciding that there was nothing for it. To get the next part of the required instrument check done, he was simply going to have to sit down at the pilot's console. This he proceeded to do, slipping through the gap between the two seats and plopping himself into the left-hand one with a minimum of grace, then burying himself furiously in the checklist. Utena watched him out of the corner of her eye as he fiddled and flipped, then asked, "What are you doing?" "Instrument check. It's required every 2 hours in metaspace. Fed flight regs. Make sure we don't go off course." "What would happen if we did?" "Well," he said, awkwardness forgotten with the technical subject to discuss, "if we were using the metaspace gate network because the ship didn't have any other FTL drive, then we'd be lost in metaspace and probably die. But Dagger Disc has hyperdrive, so we just have to lay in a course, punch across, and take the long way around instead." "Oh." Most of that had gone over Utena's head. She hadn't started studying that sort of thing yet, but the last bit was encouraging. He didn't seem very worried about getting lost in space and probably dying, so hyperdrive must be a backup system of some kind. Good enough. He seemed to notice that he'd lost her, but rather than becoming irritated at her ignorance, he asked, "Want a quick course on FTL? I just had to learn it all for my master's certificate exam, so it's still fresh in my mind." Sure. Corwin grinned and swiveled his seat to face her, sliding it back on its two-way track to make a little more space between them. She did likewise, and he spread his hands and began, "Okay, well, real space is easy. Real space is, well, real space, where the planets and stars and such are, and the speed of light is the limit and all that." She nodded. "So since the speed of light is it in real space, we have to figure out ways of either getting around the limit or getting out of real space. Right now there are basically four useful FTL methods, to do one and to do the other." Utena nodded to let him know she was paying attention. "The oldest method is one of the second kind, hyperdrive. It pushes ships into a parallel universe called hyperspace, where the speed of light limit doesn't apply. In hyperspace, a ship can go as fast as its hyperspace motivator can push it. You still have to navigate as if you were in real space, because real objects, planet size and bigger, cast sort of shadows in hyperspace. Gravity distortions, that kind of thing. They have to be avoided or you can crash into them, just like hitting the real objects in real space. Which is bad? Corwin nodded. Real bad. There generally aren't survivors. Even if the ship isn't destroyed outright, if you lose your hyperdrive envelope without transitioning back to real space, your ship and everything in it get converted instantly into random mathematical junk. It's not pretty. Still, that doesn't happen much. And with careful astrogation, hyperdrive is still the cheapest, safest FTL method out there. It takes a long time, though. If we were using hyperdrive, it'd take us a week to get from Earth to New Avalon, and Dagger Disc is one of the fastest ships around. And that wouldn't leave us much of a vacation, said Utina with a grin. Nope, that's why we're using Metaspace. It's the newest thing, just discovered in 2386 during the WDF gear-up for the War of Corporate Occupation. It's like hyperspace, but weirder. You don't need any special equipment to navigate in Metaspace. Your regular drives will do the job just fine, only to get in and out of it. So ships don't actually have to have Metaspace drive to travel in Metaspace. There are gates, fixed points where any ship can enter and exit, at most of the major systems. They're hoping to have the gate network fully up and running for all the major sectors within 5 years. Why do you say it's weirder? Because of the way it works, Corwin replied. It doesn't really map to real space one-to-one the way hyperspace does. There are some weird ripple effects and some warping. It's really complicated. I don't understand the math myself, but that's the meat of it. You navigate entirely based on course, not distance. So there have to be radio beacons at the destination points, or you wouldn't know where to come out. You can't just time it the way you would with hyperdrive. Utina nodded. Okay, that is weird. But there are no mass shadows, and it's a lot faster than hyperspace, Corwin went on. We left Earth, what, 2 hours ago? We'll be in New Avalon in another 2.5, and a half hour of that will be real space maneuvering. He stopped, awkwardness descending upon him again, and rubbed sheepishly at the back of his neck. This is probably really boring you, huh? No, not at all. I never learned much about this kind of thing before, and now I'm finding it all very interesting. Tell me about the other methods, the ones that get around the light barrier instead of leaving real space. Oh. He smiled, gratified by her interest. Well, they're really esoteric, and like I say, I'm not dialed in on the math yet or anything. That's okay, she assured him, grinning. Math and I don't get along very well either. Okay, let me see. There's warp drive. That's probably the most common method after hyperdrive. Warp drive ships kind of bend space around them. It's hard to explain without a holotank to show you the energy fields with. They sort of create a wave in space that's traveling faster than light, then surf on it, so that they're moving faster than light, but not relative to the space around them, so they get away with it. Utina scratched her head. Weird. I think I get it, but not why it works. Not many people do. I sure don't. I just think it's cool that it does. He grinned. Then there's fold drive. That one's really weird. He rummaged around in the utility bin alongside the control console and came up with a clipboard, took a sheet of paper off the top, and said, Okay, say this is space. He took the pen from the clipboard and made an X at one edge. This is where you want to go. He made an O at the other. This is where you are. Okay, said Utina. Fold drive is really funky. It basically does this to the space in between where you are and where you're headed. He took the paper and bent it, folding it in half, but not creasing it, so that X and O were adjacent. Then you just pop across and voila. Utina blinked. Whoa, what happens to everything in between? Oh, it's still there. And the people traversing inside the curl, so to speak, never notice, because if the space itself that you're traveling in is curved, you follow the curve without ever noticing it's there. The effect lasts for a really short time, too, something like a billionth of a second. You have to know where you're headed already, so it's no use for exploration, but with a fold drive you can get anywhere in the known universe instantly from anywhere else. Then why doesn't everybody just use those? Seems like it'd be easiest. Well, it's easy on the crew, but the equipment, it takes a hell of a lot of power, orders of magnitude more than any other method, and the computing power required for navigation is insane. The Wedge Defense Force used to have a class of space bomber about the size of this ship that had full drive. They had to stop operating them. Too expensive. And if something's too expensive for the WDF... He shrugged. It's really only viable for military ships. A freight consortium tried to build a fold-capable super freighter a few years ago and went bust just soliciting the design. Huh. Utena nodded, impressed. In a little under 4 minutes, he'd made sense, not very deeply explained sense, but sense, nonetheless, out of the way all these people got to and from all the different stars that formed the framework of their civilization. With the technical topic exhausted, silence suddenly returned, awkwardly. Corwin, the confidence with which he had spoken deserting him, swung his seat back into the forward-facing position and started uselessly manipulating minor controls again. To make things easier on him, Utena did the same with her seat, then leaned it back, put her hands behind her head, and looked out at metaspace some more. "Kind of creepy looking, isn't it?" she observed. "Huh? Oh. Yeah," Corwin agreed. "Hyperspace is pretty, all blue and white, and it rushes past so you really feel like you're getting someplace. And with warp drive you get this cool rainbow effect and the stars whip past." "What does fold drive look like?" "Nothing. One second you're here, flash, you're there." "Oh, that's not too exciting." "No, not really." "So, how old do you have to be to fly one of these things by yourself?" she asked after a moment's silence. "For humans, 13 with evidence of training, 15 without," Corwin replied. "The test you have to pass is brutal, though, so most people don't bother trying until they're out of school." From his tone, it was clear he wasn't boasting, just explaining. "This is my first long trip. Dad's friends think he was nuts to let me go by myself, especially with this ship. She's a real hot rod." "Seems like you're doing okay," said Utena. "You haven't gotten us killed or anything. Though I wasn't so sure you weren't going to while we were still on the ground," she added with a grin. "You don't like my driving?" he said, hurt. "I don't like having to do long division to figure out how many times the speed limit I'm going," she replied. "It's not my fault you don't like math," said Corwin. Utena opened her mouth to challenge his assumption, realized she'd told him as much not 10 minutes ago, and burst out laughing. "You should probably get some sleep," he told her when she'd finished. "New Avalon is on Earth Eastern Time, the same as Worcester. It's nearly 11 now. Going to be the middle of the night when we get in." She considered this, decided he had a point, and rose. "Thanks for the science lesson," she said. "It was fun. Maybe you can help Kate and me with our exams," she added with a grin. He blushed a little and managed to say that it would be his pleasure. She resisted the urge to scruffle his thick black hair and left the cockpit. Corwin's gold-ruffed white cat passed her in the door as she did so, ambled across the small room, and jumped up onto the control panel, deftly avoiding all the controls as he curled up on the flat dashboard above the panel. "So," said the cat, "how'd it go? Were you smooth? Is the lady impressed? Is there a torrid romance in your future? Do I get kicked out of your room?" "Shut the hell up, Noll," said Corwin grumpily. Corwin would have awakened them to show off the grandeur of the Zeta Cygni Dyson Sphere, except he was too busy arranging everything for his first solo approach and would probably have been too nervous to accomplish it with them watching him anyway. He wasn't sure what it was about Kate's roommate that made him nervous, but when she was around he couldn't seem to think straight. The phenomenon was starting to worry him a bit. He'd already made a mental note to get himself thoroughly checked out when he got back to his lab. Without any observers but Noll, who had irritated him too much earlier in the evening to make him nervous now, Corwin made his approach, transitioned into the sphere without incident, and put Dagger Disc down in his father's private revetment at Matthews Memorial Spaceport, also without incident. Once he had the ship locked down and everything secure by the checklist, he went aft and realized he was an idiot. "Forgot to tell her there were staterooms, huh?" Noll inquired from his shoulder as he stood frowning down at the wardroom sofa, where Utena had made a pillow out of her jacket and was having the recommended nap. She didn't look too terribly inconvenienced by the conditions, curled up on her side with one arm under her head and the other hand tucked up under her chin, but he still felt like an idiot for not pointing out the fact that there were actual places to sleep aboard ship. He stood looking down at her. All she wore under that jacket was a tank top. She must have been kind of cold in the air-conditioned cabin. His frown slowly easing into a sort of blank look, and wondered what he'd been trying to think of. Damn it, there it went again. What the hell was the matter with him? He shook his head. Nall made a soft noise that might have been a snicker, but hid behind Corwin's own head when Corwin tried to give him a look. Now what the hell's so funny? He muttered, then reached hesitantly out, paused, and finally, very tentatively, touched Utina's bare shoulder. Huh? She turned slightly onto her back, opened her eyes, and looked up at him, focusing slowly. Oh, Corwin, she said, her voice a little blurred with sleep. Everything okay? Yeah, he replied. We're here. Well, that was a stupid way to put it, he thought. Nall made that noise again. Here? Utina replied. She sat up, wiped a hand down her face with a soft groan, and focused on him again, more easily this time. New Avalon? Yeah, Corwin repeated. She grinned a little at him. He wondered what for, and stood up, then slowly and gloriously stretched. Corwin felt his ears get hot and thought about absolutely nothing whatsoever. Nall made that noise again. Is something wrong with your cat? Utina asked as she shrugged back into her jacket. No, said Corwin. He's just enjoying all this a little too much for some reason. Are you going to set her straight, or should I? Nall asked. Utina did a double take, then blinked at him. Go ahead, you've already started, said Corwin, a note of resignation in his voice. All right, then. Nall drew himself up to his full seated height, a whopping, 8 inches, maybe, cleared his throat, and announced grandly, I am Nall Silverclaw, White Dragon of Alfheim, faithful friend and boon companion to this hopeless lout. He gestured with his little feline head at Corwin, who was now scowling, arms folded across his chest. Utina blinked again, then smiled. You're a dragon. That's right. So you're not a cat? No, I am not a cat, Nall replied pompously. I am a great Alfheim cat dragon, entirely not a common cat. Oh, said Utina with a mischievous grin. She reached out and started scratching the top of Nall's head between his ears. So you probably don't like this, then? Well, there are many similarities between common cats and Alfheim cat dragons, said Nall, haltingly, as his instinct to purr kept interfering with his speaking voice. Is that a fact? Utina asked conversationally, stepping up the speed and force of the scratching. Nall replied, sagging down into a limp bundle. We don't like to talk about it, but it's true. I like her, Corwin. Let's keep her. Corwin reddened. Utina finished scruffling Nall and again suppressed the urge to repeat the procedure on Corwin, opting instead for whacking him companionably on the arm and saying, Where's Kate hiding? There are a couple of staterooms on board. I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you about them. You didn't have to sleep on the couch. That's okay, she said, unconcerned. I've slept on worse. Worse than what? Asked Kate as she emerged from the curving corridor which led forward to the captain's cabin. The couch, said Utina, as she buttoned her jacket. Corwin forgot to tell me there were real beds on board, but it's okay. It was only a short nap anyway. Corwin unloaded his car from Dagger Disc's small cargo bay, and the four of them climbed aboard and set off. It didn't look like much at first. Matthews Memorial Spaceport looked much like Burke Lakefront Spaceport in Cleveland had, right down to the fact that there was a lake nearby. It was only after they got out onto the highway ramp and negotiated the long, sweeping right-hand turn onto Highway 29 that the city and the sphere suddenly sprang into glittering view, making Utina, to whom Kate had deliberately yielded the shotgun seat, gasp in awe. It rose up out of the shores of Daniel's Lake, rising high into the velvety, starless blackness of the night sky in a blazing, golden gleam, its spires and towers reaching upward to dizzying, impossible heights. Several of the buildings, the Gothic spire, the shimmering Art Deco monolith, the smooth, glittering silver tower, were so tall their tops couldn't be seen from inside the car, even at this distance. One enormous building in the center was not all that tall-looking compared to its neighbors, but was enormous in bulk. A great scarlet and chrome-stepped pyramid, proudly displaying the name of the Aztechnology Corporation on its highest, narrowest step. Surrounding all this was a colony of lesser buildings, which would have been remarkable in themselves in either of the Earth cities Utina had seen, but here were merely humble neighbors to the giants that lived in the center of downtown. The skies above this great city teemed with activity, even at this late hour. Some aerodynes and air cars, but mainly airships, rigid, semi-rigid, and non-rigid alike, cruising here and there on errands known only to their crews and dispatchers. Some were just flying advertisements. Others monitored traffic. A few were owned by the New Avalon Police Department. As for the rest, who knew? Deliveries, pickups, people just out for a cruise. Hundreds of them, filling the skies with an orderly and leisurely pattern of winking lights and glowing gas bags. Wow. Utina murmured. Corwin grinned, fully at ease for the first time since his impromptu science lesson. Great, isn't it? Dad's best work. Your father made this? She asked wonderingly. Well, designed it, said Corwin. He had a little help putting it up. And it's grown since then, of course. They broke ground in 2381. He pointed to the Gothic spire. That's the entire state building. It's the tallest freestanding structure in the known universe. His finger traversed to the silver tower. Genom Tower, which I think is number 2 or maybe 3. And that gorgeous Art Deco job, that's my favorite, I love that retro stuff, is the Imperial Hotel Monolith, the galaxy's largest hotel. I stayed there once last year just to do it. It's awesome. It's beautiful inside as out. And, of course, the Aztechnology Pyramid, they use it for their corporate symbol. Utina nodded. I thought I'd seen it before. Wow, she repeated. Now she was speaking of the whole city again. She hadn't made a verbal transition, but Corwin somehow understood as she went on. It's so beautiful. Corwin glanced smiling at her rapt profile, opened his mouth as if to say something, then thought better of it and returned his attention to the road. Null made that noise again. Corwin idly swatted the dragon with his free hand, which caused him to abandon Corwin's shoulder in a huff and go take up a similar position on Utina's. In the back, Kate just smiled as though to herself and said nothing. She was enjoying everybody else's reactions too much to bother with her own. He took them the long way around, taking half an hour to drive a lap around New Avalon on 29 so that Utina could take it in from every grounded angle, before finally turning off and making his way through side streets into a quiet residential neighborhood out on the edge of town. Here, on a pleasant little loop of a street, he guided his long black car about halfway around anti-clockwise, before pulling into the driveway of a big gray house on the left. It was hard to see much of the house in the dark, but Utina got the impression, from the little carriage lamp that lit the edge of the driveway, that it was shingled rather than sided, and probably 3 stories high. A large brass plate next to the front door, just visible in the stoop light, read, 105 Morgan Lane. Corwin got their bags from the trunk of his car and led both girls along a walkway shoveled out of the 2-foot-deep snow lining the front yard, up 4 steps, and to the front door of the house. Here he fumbled a bit with his keys until Kate, with an exasperated sound, took her suitcase from him so that he'd have at least one free hand. With mumbled thanks, like all of them, his energy level was flagging, it had been a long day, he got the door open and led them inside. Utina didn't see much of the inside of the house, either. She took off her shoes in a foyer-type thing, then went through an archway, across a large, comfortable living room, and up a staircase to a longish hallway that had six doors and another stairway. With a whispered, good night, sleep well, Kate took her suitcase and went up the next flight of stairs. Corwin quietly showed Utena to the door at the opposite end to the right. "Here's the guest room," he murmured. "I'm next door, if you need anything." He trailed off, realizing how what he'd been about to say sounded. Well, I'm next door anyway. She smiled, resisted yet again that powerful urge to muss up his already mussed hair, transferred the now profoundly asleep Nall from her shoulder to his, and patted him on the arm again. "Good night, Corwin," she whispered. "Thanks for the drive around the city. It was beautiful. I'd like to see more of it before I leave." I think I can arrange that," said Corwin with a rather shy smile. Impulsively, Utena touched him briefly on the cheek, then scratched the sleeping Nall behind the ears and went into the guest room, closing the door behind with another whispered, "Good night." Corwin remained standing in the hall, fingertips raised in puzzlement to the burning spot in his face where she'd touched him, for several moments, before he finally shook his head and made his way, still confused, to his bed. Utena awoke slowly, noted as she did every morning that she was still alone. What was she expecting, she wondered every time, elves to come in the night and give her her old life back? And turned onto her back as she came fully awake to look up at the line of sunlight the closed curtains were allowing to track across the ceiling of the guest room. She didn't know what time it was, and was feeling entirely too lazy to turn her head the requisite 50 or so degrees and look at the clock she could hear ticking on the bedside stand. The bed was a great deal more comfortable than the narrow institution-issue rack she slept on at WPI, and she just wanted to lie here for as long as she could get away with it and go back over the events of the last few days. Where the hell had Sionji sprung from? It was a shame he hadn't been coherent enough to mention that. Still, paradoxically, his sudden, violent appearance had given Utena something like hope. If he could come here, then why couldn't she go back? She just had to figure out how he'd done it. Unfortunately, that would mean talking to him for long enough to get him to explain it, and since his pupils had been the size of purely theoretical particles when she'd last seen him, she didn't have high hopes of finding him in a chatty mood the next time they crossed paths. In fact, now that he was around, she was going to have to get back into training, find a sword somewhere, figure out a way to carry it hidden like Kate did, be ready to protect herself. The thought didn't disturb her as much as she'd have thought. In fact, she noted with a little self-mocking smile, she was kind of looking forward to the next time he came around. Toward the end, back home, he'd started acting kind of like an actual person, so she had to wonder what had happened to set him back. Maybe just being brought here, she supposed. But all the same, it would be good stress relief to whack the stuffing out of her old pal Kyuichi without anything on the line but her own life. A pang of guilt stabbed at her as she reflected that life was certainly simpler without all the trappings of the tournament and the academy surrounding her. She sighed, took a deep breath, and then held it for a moment, given pause by something she'd smelled in the air. She sat up in one smooth movement as though propelled by a lever, let out her breath, sniffed, sniffed again. "Waffles," she murmured. She got up, put on her slippers, belted her dressing gown on over her pajamas, and went out into the hall. There she had to pause for a moment to get her bearings. It had been very late when she'd arrived, before remembering that the stairs were at the end of the hall to the left. From there, navigating to the kitchen was easy. She rounded the corner from the den and passed through the archway, then stopped short with a gasp. Standing in the middle of the kitchen, juggling sausage links and patties in a frying pan while a waffle iron steamed happily on the central counter, was a tall, dark, slightly menacing figure in black clothes and an apron emblazoned with the slogan, "Eat or Die." Utena recognized him instantly, but had never expected to see him here. Wasn't really certain she'd ever see him again. "You!" she blurted, eyes wide. Megazone looked up from his work with the sausages and grinned. "Ah, you're awake," he said. It was the same first thing he'd said to her last time, and it ricocheted through her brain and brought the whole thing rushing back in a solid block. Utna heaved herself up from a nightmarish vision of falling, of shattered stone and hatred given wing, a cry on her lips, her left arm extended before her until she thought her shoulder must break. To find herself in a bedroom. A lavish one, large and sumptuously, but tastefully appointed in black marble, chrome, and what looked like teak. She had never been in it before. Never seen the black and red striped coverlet she'd thrown off herself sitting up. Never seen the pale blue, ruffle-fronted nightdress she was wearing. The cry died away into a question mark, and the bowstring tension drained out of her body, leaving her slumped with her face buried in her hands, trying to figure out what could possibly have happened to her. The door to the room opened, and she looked up, tensing, ready to fight or run as the occasion demanded. In the doorway stood a man she'd never seen before. He was very tall and quite broad, with long, dark brown hair and an imposing brow over deep-set, dark eyes, a sharp-pointed nose and a fringe of beard. He was dressed entirely in black. Black jeans, a black t-shirt with the stylized logo reading, Lindblad Machine Guns, Anti-Personnel for the 23rd Century, and a long, flappy black leather trench coat. He didn't look particularly hostile, but his aspect was threatening just by its very darkness. She drew back, fists tightening, but he only smiled. "Ah, you're awake," he said. "Who are you?" she demanded. "Where am I?" "Ah, the eternal questions," he said in a musing tone. "Who are you? Where am I? They are the two most fundamental things everyone wants to know." He regarded her steadily for a moment, making her feel even more uneasy, then grinned. "Sorry, lost my train of thought. I'm Megazone, you can call me Zoner, and you're in the palace suite of the Worcester Crown Plaza Hotel." "Worcester," she said, the word unfamiliar on her tongue. "Where in the world is that?" "Well, it's not in the world you're used to, I'm afraid."
"What?"
Well, hold on a second." He held up a hand in a one-moment please gesture and rummaged through the inside pocket of his coat for a few seconds, then pulled out a blue and white book that didn't seem like it would have fit, and tossed it to her. She picked it up, turned it over, and looked at the cover. "So you've just arrived from a parallel dimension. A survival guide for cross-time travelers. Lieutenant Commander Derek Bacon, Morale Officer, Wedge Defense Force."
"Parallel dimension?" Utna said,
then looked up at him with skeptical eyes.
"What kind of trick is this? Where am I? Are you working for him?"
Zoner blinked. "Well, I don't know what kind of trick it is. You're the one who appeared out of nowhere. I told you where you are, and I'm not working for anybody. Well, nobody you'd know, anyway. Well, no, not really anybody at all. More like some thing." He waved his hands dismissively. "But that's not important right now." He crossed the room, staying well clear of the bed, and opened the closet. "I got you some clothes. Didn't know what you'd like, so I just got a couple more of what you were wearing. Interesting style choice, very martial, but it looks good on you. I couldn't decide if you'd prefer a nightgown or PJs, so I flipped a coin." He turned, saw the utterly baffled look on her face, and sighed elaborately. "Damn, I knew I should have gone with PJs. I'll put in an order right away. Anyway, you know how to use a telephone?" Blank-faced with the conflicting mix of emotions and impression running through her mind, Utna only nodded silently. "Okay, good," said Zoner. "If you're hungry, order room service. Get whatever you want, just bill it to the room. Palace suite, room 2. I'm in room 1 if you want anything." And with that, he was gone. Slowly, numbly, she started reading the book. It was well-written, concise, and somehow completely believable. By the end of the first chapter, describing the conditions under which a person might find him or herself transported to a parallel dimension, she was starting to be convinced. She got up as if in a trance and looked out the window, and looked out through the gap in the curtains. Outside was a city, but not like she had ever seen before. It gleamed in what looked like noonday sunlight, an assemblage of concrete and glass towers, with flying machines scooting back and forth between the buildings. There were still trees and green patches. Off to the left was what looked like a park, and perhaps a school campus. But this city could never be Sephirian. The glass, the lights, the flying machines, all made that perfectly plain. So the book was right. Then it hit her what that meant. Utna spent the rest of the afternoon huddled under the covers, shivering uncontrollably, tears pouring down her face until she felt she must eventually run out of them through sheer dehydration. Finally, drained and exhausted, she got up from the bed, dragged herself to the bathroom, and regarded her red-eyed, tear-streaked face in the mirror. Was this what it was all for? The ultimate prize? Banishment from her home? Well, such as it was, she supposed, but Otori Academy had still been her home, and everyone she loved. Her life's work a lie, and the truth she'd fought so hard to discover in its place stolen away from her forever? What a cruel joke. The universe couldn't really be that cold a place, could it? Could it? She leaned on the counter and looked down into the sink, feeling another wave of wrenching grief pass over her. Her head swam, but no more tears came. She noticed a bandage at the base of the third finger of her left hand. The next thing Utna knew, she was sitting in the tub, curled into a ball with the shower pounding down over her. Somewhere along the line, she'd taken the scissors from the little sewing kit on the counter and cut off most of her long pink hair. It lay scattered on the bathroom floor like discarded straw, along with shattered drinking glasses, torn towels, and the twisted remains of the towel rack. This wasn't grief. It was rage. Incoherent, useless rage, her soul rebelling against the idea that she might, probably would, never see Wakaba or Miki or Juri ever again. Never know if she had succeeded. Never hold Anthy in her arms. Never hear her say that it was all over and done with at last, and they could finally have their lives to live for themselves and each other. She came back to herself cold and sore and feeling a bit foolish on top of everything else. She got up, turned off the shower, and climbed out of the tub. She picked her way through the rubble, startled now at the amount of havoc she'd wrecked, and dried herself on the one surviving towel which had been hidden on a rack on the back of the door. Her reflection was distorted somewhat by a network of cracks raying out from a dent in the mirror. She glanced down at her smarting left hand to see the cuts on her knuckles, the blood washed away by the shower. Sighing, she treated them with the first aid kit she found in the cabinet under the sink, from which she'd wrenched one of the doors. Then picked up the scissors from where she'd flung them and touched up her impromptu haircut as best she could, converting it from a demolished haystack into a serviceable gammon bob. Now she looked as strange to herself as she felt. Her hair hadn't been this short since she'd been too young to remember. Wearily, Utna cleaned up as much of the mess she'd made as possible, put on the bathrobe hanging on the inside of the door, and went outside. Her bed had been made while she was in there. How long it had been, she had no idea, but it was dark outside the windows. The tear-soaked pillowcases replaced, the coverlet turned down, with a neatly folded set of pink flannel pajamas and a little round chocolate mint placed squarely on the fold. She looked around, but saw no one. She put on the pajamas, then ate the mint, which reminded her suddenly that she was ravenously hungry. Remembering Megazone's advice, she ordered a hamburger and fries from room service, scarfed them down, called for another order, and took her time with that one while she pursued the second chapter of the book. Utna Tenjo was a fundamentally resilient young woman. Her reaction to setbacks, even ones as profound and shattering as this one, was generally to pick herself up, dust herself off, grit her teeth, and climb back on the horse. But in this case, the horse himself seemed to have gone missing, so she felt at a little bit of a loss. She slept uneasily that night, plagued by dreams of all she had lost. The next morning, the man called Megazone knocked discreetly and came in only when invited, to find her sitting up cross-legged on the bed, the book beside her. He made no comment on her revised hairstyle, and brushed off her halting apology for the undoubtedly expensive damage she'd dealt the bathroom. I've been asked, he told her, to see that you're kept safe. As luck would have it, I think that can probably be best accomplished right here in Worcester. There's a private school here in town, Worcester Preparatory Institute. Very high academic standards, very well run, extremely safe. I have other responsibilities that make it impossible for me to look after you myself, but the people at WPI can do a better job of it than I could anyway. I don't have any money, Utina told him. I don't have anything, other than the clothes I showed up in. Don't be silly. Why, you have four of that outfit, and three sets of pajamas and a suitcase. As for money, I can set you up with a stipend. Did you get through the book? She nodded. Good, then you'll know about bank cards and all that. He dug around in the inside pocket of his coat and tossed a handful of documents onto the bed in front of her. There's all the identity documents you'll need, passport, personal ID card, all that junk. You're a citizen of the Republic of Zeta Cygni. No guardian, you seem together enough to be an emancipated minor. Easier that way, too. Nobody to report to. No fixed address. Don't need 'em. She blinked down at the pile of vital documents. There was indeed a passport and an ID card, also a registration document from something called the Psi Corps, certifying her to be devoid of any quantifiable telepathic or other psionic talent, whatever that meant. A red plastic card bearing the sigil of the Wedge Defense Force Members and Veterans Federated Credit Union, and several other official-looking oddments whose purpose she could not immediately divine. Is this all legitimate? Megazone grinned. But of course, my dear. The guy who runs Zeta Cygni is an old friend. Nothing could have been simpler. Why are you doing this? It must have been harder than you're letting on, and expensive. You've never seen me before in your life, and you're taking me in, buying me clothes, giving me a whole identity, talking about sending me to an exclusive school. Who are you? Zoner stood up, still smiling. She got the impression not at her, but at something just outside her view. I'm a strange attractor, he said. A throw of the dice that's gone your way, and from the looks of things, you were due. Tomorrow, if you want to go, I'll take you to WPI for the admissions test. Your previous school records are unavailable. Some sort of tragic mishap, you understand, with the files. So you'll have to test in. She gave him a dubious look. Or you could call a cab, he said, and I'll meet you up there. She waited. He was big, sturdy, very strong-looking. If there were some ulterior motive, some darker purpose in his kindness, he could have exacted whatever price he felt like right here, at any time in the last 24 hours. Something in the way he moved told her that if such a thing had crossed his mind, she'd never have been able to stop him, not as she was now, anyway. Something else, maybe in his eyes, told her it hadn't. She nodded. Okay, I'll go with you.